I still don't think...
Based on the premise that you would have multiple people in multiple locations. Kaiser had people in Denver, San Jose, San Francisco.
Well, we don't need to climb up.
Competitors in Chicago.
You haven't even been sure.
Yeah, but this is fine.
Contributing to managing the energy development in general.
So it would be important, I think, that there not be some massive... installation of software that would be required based on what we're learning in the mouse, is this relationship right? Or could you look at this relationship? And there needs to be a simple process where
today there is a reliance on Apple One's software.
Mary and I were discussing
it. Yeah, you can export and then translate, which a number of people do. Alan and his people had experience with that. But the whole idea is that as this new organization is formed, there will be a new technical infrastructure. Open source tools, not necessarily Protege. Protege still is inadequate to the task. The terminology is biggest. Because difference or whether this one is different. Consider whether it's a continuum or a current. And they go,
Yeah.
So is it something that happens, or is it something that just exists? And they still go,
It's great.
I think we're almost there, but it's taken this 3 or 4 years really pounding on this issue.
So
to figure out So, know, when I've gone to these people and said, there's this community out there that you're not serving well, they just sort of like, you know, how much money are they going to give us? None. And they say, well, so, you know, just get out of here. And it's been very difficult. I think we now have an opportunity to transition to raise awareness that there's a whole community of people who are interested in using terminology and building it.
The argument is that you're expanding the number of people that can apply a scholarship to the development of a whole overall system, and that's regards to taking those information, maybe.
Well, in the new environment, I think it will be hard to say that. And this will be the time to just at the beginning
So another question.
It's 11 o'clock. We should start again. Please take your seats.
So that we have a face to approach.
And fasten your seatbelts for the next presentation.
So we certainly forcing you to use that.
Okay. I was able to.
Barry, how does this work?
You press the button at the top, which may be already pressed.
Yeah.
Public
Down. Eric,
there's a folder in here that says for Barry. There are four papers using gene ontology, and then there's a separate file of the references. Two are published, one's accepted, one's
okay.
Submit your work.
Does this work? Do you hear me?
Just hit it.
No, it's not working. So.
The eventual process. But I got to say that this is. That this is the seems that they different types. I seem to have a different check to create a different type.
Right, so
I might want to have a type.
Let me turn it.
But my
can you get
a cancer treatment?
Why don't you have
a basic disease versus non treatment disease? That's fine.
Yeah, I think that's
the other might have.
Okay, the wireless doesn't work, so I will have to use this one. Okay, I'm going to talk about a very related topic, the ontology of diagnosis. And my presentation has 6 parts. I start with some what I consider to be important background notions on ontology. Then I will dive into what's a diagnosis. I will show you that in order to be able to do that, I must be able to give some answer on what is a disease. It has to be defined, although I don't care too much in relationship to a diagnosis how it is going to be defined. I will then discuss diagnostic decision making from an ontological and epistemological perspective. I'll discuss the impact of change on making diagnosis, and when there is time enough, I will cover the topic of how to track changes in representations. So let's start with the background. As you know, I'm very much in favor of a realist view of the world, and I believe that the world consists of entities that are either particulars or universals. Particulars are me and you and this table and this microphone. Universals are things such as person, table, microphone. Either occurrence or continuance, so the things that undergo processes and the processes themselves. Dependent and independent things. And also that there are relationships between these entities which fall into 3 categories, between particulars and universals, between particulars and particulars, or between universals and universals. Yes? I don't see any other possible combination if you have only 2 other things. If you just have particulars and universals, I don't see what other kind of relationships you might have in which you use those 2 things.
You can reverse universal particular.
Yeah, well, but that's
curious in
fact. And Cindy, it's no problem. If you have any questions, I prefer that you ask them immediately. There are three levels inside reality. It's perhaps not right to say three levels of reality, but there are inside reality. First one is that the world exists as it is prior to a cognitive agent's perception thereof. So we do not create a world. It's not because we see it in a certain way that the world is that way. It is there, and because it is there, and because of a number of other things, we are able to see it and to get a perception of it. Second level of reality is that cognitive agents build up in their minds that are quotes, okay? So I'm not claiming here that there is such a thing as a mind, right? But let's use it in the colloquial form of the meaning. So cognitive agents build up in their minds cognitive representations of that world. And the third level is that in order to make these representations publicly accessible in some enduring fashion, they create representational artifacts. And those artifacts, they are fixed in some medium.
Seems like my better note works.
So, a couple of examples of representational artifacts. They all share the fact that they are built out of representational units and relationships that mirror the entities and their relationships in reality. That's, I said, ideally. Okay, so that's the aim that we should strive for. And we can divide them in a couple of categories, whether they are formalized or not formalized, and whether they are primarily about particulars or primarily about universals and defined classes. So of the first sort, you have things such as the progress notes, discharge letters, medical summaries, but also maps that help you to drive to a city or to the state. Formalized things about particulars are inventories, databases, specific example being a reference tracking database that I will discuss a little bit later. Representational artifacts, primarily about universals, are medical textbooks, scientific theories, and if they are formalized, I have things such as ontologies, terminologies, and all those nice things. So, I dropped already the name reference tracking. That's my prime area of research. The purpose of reference tracking is to make explicit reference to the concrete individual entities relevant to the accurate description of each patient's conditions, therapies, outcomes, and so on. And there was already a guy who had that idea on that cartoon. I said, okay, we have to label everything that we see. Well, I prefer not to use words, but I prefer to use what I call instance unique identifiers, so simply numbers. And each thing gets its own number. So let's take an example. If you would have in an electronic healthcare record system a statement such as John Doe's liver tumor was treated with RPCI's irradiation device. So normally you would, in the spirit of annotation, you would assign to all those things some terms which come from an ontology or a terminology. In reference tracking, I say no, you have first to do something else, that is to see which of those things refer to individual entities and then give them a number if they have not already been assigned a number to. If they have already been assigned a number to, then you use that number. So suppose that this is the very first sentence that you are going to annotate in your system. Now you create six new numbers. You take some ontology or terminology and you say that at a certain time these things are instances of the things on the right hand side. If you have a similar sentence in another electronic health record, you do exactly the same thing. You assign numbers, and then you state that these things are instances of those entities from an ontology. And you see here, because they came from electronic health records of the same institution, that in this case, RPCI, which is the hospital, and their irradiation device, in both cases, the same number is used there. So that is additional information that you get by using those unique identifiers, what you would not have if you annotate directly by using terms from an ontology. So that is some concrete advantage. Now, of course, repositories and the ontologies, they have to work together. So what you do if you express certain things is relate everything at a particular basis to each other, and the things that go up to the ontology are only instance relationships. So under that paradigm, there is nothing else than at this level, instance of. Of course, if you have a much richer ontology, such that as the ontology of biomedical reality, which is under development, then you can do more interesting things.
Does the ontology of biomedical reality bear any relationship to the disease ontology?
Of course, that's part. The disease ontology would be part of it. So, second part, what's the diagnosis? So the naive view would be, if we go again to those kind of things, if we have our ontology, we say, okay, there are some manifestations, they are the cause of something which is a disease, and we give that disease also a number, okay? And now we say this is an instance of that, and this is an instance of that, and so on. Nice thing of this approach is already that you can assign already an identifier to a thing which you say it is a disease without you knowing already what kind of disease it exactly is. Okay, so that is the kind of evidence, that is the kind of information that you gain afterwards when evidence is accumulated about what the nature of the disease might be. Now let's expand that naive version towards a full picture. So we have our level of biomedical reality. Persons, diseases, pathological structures, and pathological formations, they exist as particulars, and they are also related to universals, and these are related in specific ways, I repeat again, prior to our perception. Biomedical reality changes, right? So diseases and particulars, they come and they go. Universals, they come. Yesterday, Barry told me that they might disappear as well. I have to think about it. There is the level of biomedical science and case perception. Now, although we strive to get a perfect perception of what is going on in reality, we end up with representations which mirror reality only partially. But it is true that when we are discovering more and more about reality, that those perceptions improve. So we are moving towards a better understanding, hopefully. And at the level of the concretizations, there are also some important remarks to make. Because of our limited perception, they mirror biomedical science and case perception only also partially, for additional reasons. We can make editing mistakes, okay, in an ontology. We can leave out diseases or pathological behaviors for non-biomedical reasons. Remember the thing on smoking, which went in and out ICD years ago. Or what was discussed yesterday, homosexuality, whether it is pathological behavior, yes or no. So, therefore, this brings my working definition of diagnosis as this. It is any configuration of representational units which is believed to mirror the portion of reality consisting of an organism's disease and the relationships this disease enjoys with the entities that cause the disease or influence its cause, whereby some part of this configuration of representational units refers to the universal of which that disease is believed to be an instance, or the defined class of which it is believed to be a member. Now take that. Objections?
This is a particular meeting, and I like the specificity. It isn't the meaning of the word diagnosis that is commonly then modified by a number of different adjectives, such as working, differential, provisional, admitting, discharge, etc. Those are tags that have administrative purposes and admit more than this.
Yes. Okay, I forgot to say in the beginning. I said I have to say it and I forgot it. So if you have questions that are informative, you may ask them immediately and I'll answer. You may also have critiques. This is a critique, right? And if you have a critique, then I consider my thinking good when the critique will be answered in a few slides later, it will be done. This is 1-0. Yes.
Yeah, what about the case called diagnosis?
Yeah.
Where there is a representational unit, for instance, that I have, say, renal failure or something like that. Indeed, I haven't. And so it's believed, but in the third paragraph,
This one?
It's believed to be an instance.
Yes. Good. Let's continue. So, by the way, I introduced here sneakily universal versus defined class. I think it's important that you understand what I mean by that. So we have here, oops, I'm going too fast now. You have here, probably you can't read it, John's lung inflammation, Mary's lung inflammation, Jew's liver inflammation. You have here John's lung, Mary's lung, Jew's liver, and there is a Hess location relationship from one to the other. Okay. So universals are at this site, okay? So we'll say that John's lung inflammation is an instance at time t of an inflammation, and so is Mary's lung inflammation, and so is Joe's liver inflammation. And also, John's lung is an instance at time t of liver, Mary's lung is an instance of lung, Joe's liver is an instance of lung. But there are other things such as lung inflammation. Okay, now I'm not, don't hang on too much on this thing, whether it lung inflammation is a good example. It's just for the sake of the argument. Now, we can say that John's lung inflammation and Mary's lung inflammations are lung inflammations. Okay. Now, I would say that lung inflammation is not a universal, but it is a defined class. It would be a universal if lung inflammations have something in essence, okay, which is more than inflammations have. Okay. But nevertheless, in ontologies, we like to have those kind of things. So in SNOMED you have those labels, diseases by body part, or you have it in any way.
Can you explain in very short, what's the difference between a universal and a defined class?
Well, if you take the extension of a universal, then you have all the instances fall under it. For a defined class, it is not the case. So the extension of a defined class is not the maximality of what you can get, okay? Because there are other inflammations. And the fact that it is in the lung, unless I say there is some essence to it, but it's just accidental. It is not such for an inflammation that they have to be in the lung.
So I would express it as follows. Universals are the kinds of things which can be investigated directly in scientific investigation. So cell designates a universal, electron designates a universal. And then the issue about disease versus syndrome is which are those things which correspond to some universal, something general in reality, which could be the object of scientific investigation. A defined class is something like all participants in clinical trial number 4721. There's nothing about all of those participants which makes that collection an object of scientific investigation. That collection is a defined class. It's a fiat entity rather than something which exists in nature.
So, but you said that lung inflammation.
I didn't. He did.
Oh.
So the issue here is where do we draw the line between universals on the one hand and defined classes on the other hand?
Right.
And that is an issue which you're quite right to draw attention to. But this is a boundary issue, and remember, yesterday we all promised not to address boundary issues.
I just wanted to be clear that I wasn't missing something that was
not. But the important part is that where, let's say, maybe 2 years ago, I would have said that in an ontology only belongs universals, I can also say, okay, but we can deal with these kinds of defined classes. Okay. But they are given a very strict interpretation, which is strict and still acceptable under a realist view. Okay, so this is an example of a well-formed diagnosis of pneumococcal pneumonia, right? So it is a configuration of representational units. It is believed to mirror the person's disease. It is believed to mirror the disease's cause, and it refers to the universal of which a disease is believed to be an instance. So it satisfies the definition that I gave. So motivations and consequences. In the definition, I did not need to use debatable or ambiguous notions such as proposition, statement, assertion, fact, and those kind of things. So I just am restricted to representational units. The same diagnosis can be expressed in various forms. So I could have done it this way, by saying number 56 is a pneumococcal pneumonia, or I could say that number 6 is called by number 78, and number 56 is pneumonia, and number 78 is a portion of pneumococcus. Which, of course, is true when, at the level of reality, at universals and defined classes, this is true. Okay? Another advantage is that a diagnosis or a motivation, a diagnosis can be of level 2 or level 3, either in the mind of a cognitive agent or in some physical form. It allows also for a clean interpretation of assertions of the sort that these patients have the same diagnosis. Okay? How do we need to interpret that? Well, we have to interpret it in a way that the configuration of representational units is such that the parts which do not refer to the particulars related to the respective patients refer to the same portion of reality. Right? So this case. So these are, of course, distinct diagnoses. This is number one. And this is number two. But in colloquial language, we can say it's the same. Because except for the particulars itself, they refer to the same general things. It allows also, and that's your question, your remark, for a clean interpretation for the wealth of what are modified or specified diagnoses. Okay, with respect to the order of the representation, nursing diagnosis, referral diagnosis, or when created, postoperative diagnosis, or degree of the belief, uncertain diagnosis, preliminary diagnosis. So it works out for these things as well.
But actually, you haven't completely answered the issue that I raised, and that is that sometimes, even though it says admitting diagnosis, it doesn't mean the diagnosis assigned at the time of admission. Mm-hmm. It really means an administratively defined category or data field to which you can assign this set of things but not that set of things. So it's in other words, we have to be careful that the label admitting diagnosis is not universally interpreted to mean the diagnosis assigned at the time of admission.
No, of course not. But that's not the kind of thing that I'm claiming. Okay. What you are saying, in fact, that there is diagnosis 1, diagnosis 2, diagnosis 3, diagnosis 4, and so on. Okay, so there are different entities in reality which we, in our sloppy way of dealing with language, get all the label of diagnosis. Okay, if you are aware of that, and as a builder of a co-builder of SNOMED, well, then put it in your terminology, right?
Well, actually, this is an information model issue. In other words, people want to take the label admitting diagnosis and have it mean the same thing across multiple different institutions, and in fact, that breaks because there are some institutions that have rules about it that are different from others. So that's
okay.
All I'm pointing out that the phrase admitting diagnosis is not as precisely defined in practical use as what you're presenting.
No, okay, I can accept that certainly. In any case, so the reminder of my presentation, so when I use the word diagnosis, it means exactly that what I just described, okay? So don't assume that I'm using the word under different meanings. But it requires working out a couple of other things. So at the level of biomedical reality, what is the disease? What are the entities that cause a specific disease to exist or influence the course? What are the relationships between these entities and the disease? It's also working out at the level of representation or artifacts. How do they relate to reality? And how keeping track of changes in reality? So part three, what is a disease? In order to get an answer, I looked up some definitions that were on the website and on some other places. And I just retained those who have really nice, well, some nice elements to it. And this one from WHO has some nice things to it. So an interconnected set of one or more dysfunctions in one or more body systems, including a pattern of signs, symptoms, and findings, and so forth and so forth. You can read. Nevertheless, there are some remarks. In one or more body systems, I assume of one single person. There are exceptions to that. So there is a psychiatry, you have the folie à deux, where two people are in the same imaginary world, let us say, of false beliefs. So that might be an exception to that thing, being in one single person. They talk about dysfunctions, but they don't specify what is referred to by that word, dysfunction. Is it a non-canonical functioning, as we saw yesterday, or is it a functioning which may lead to harming the diseased person? And non-canonical does not necessarily mean harmful, but it can be a dysfunction. A set is not an ontological entity, but it's a representational entity. So it's very hard to say that a disease is a representational entity. It is something real. Better would then be that they said, okay, a disease involves one or more sets. Involves one or more dysfunctions in one or more, and so on. But then it is still left open what the disease is. Okay, they only say what it would say what it involves. Or another way would be the processual entity composed of the dysfunctionings would also be better. They introduce findings there. I don't have problems with signs and symptoms, I have problems with findings, because that violates the principle of the a priori reality. So it would seem as if diseases would only exist if we look for them. If you take finding as an essential element in your definition. And then there was an ontology-inspired definition, which came from a paper that we published in end of last year. It starts by saying that an organism or part of an organism is diseased if it includes among its parts pathological anatomical structures which compromise the organism's physiological processes to the degree that they give rise to symptoms and signs. And this one is further based on the notion of an anatomical structure which is pathological, for which the following criteria have been given. It has come into being as a result of changes in some pre-existing canonical anatomical structure. Through processes other than the expression of the normal complement of genes of an organism of the given type, and which is predisposed to have health-related consequences for the organism in question, manifested by symptoms and signs. Come later back to that. So what are some origins of pathological structures? Well, at molecular levels, you can have defective pieces of DNA, transcription mistakes or mutations, which can be the result of a random event or environmental effect, radiation, chemicals, viruses. And these result in cellular dysfunction or structural damage. And at higher levels of granularity, you can have traumas, which results in cellular organ or system damage directly. Note that at that time we also said an organism is diseased, and we did not say what the disease is. No, at that time we did not want to make a commitment to it. Now I dare to do so. So my first tentative definition of disease would be inspired on those previous ones. Is it a disposition which, when realized, has health-related consequences for the well-being of the organism or any of its parts?
Does it have to be adverse health-related consequences?
Good.
Yes, that's missing from here.
Right.
And if one of my cells has such a disposition, then am I diseased?
I'll come to that also. It's 3-0.
What's disposition? I'm disposed to freeze in minus 50. Is it a disease?
I take disposition in the sense as Neil expressed yesterday. I would not take it in the sense as a propensity or risk, which is something else.
Isn't that passing the buck from disease to health?
Yes, 4-0. Right? What is problematic? The notion of well-being is at least some circularity which is non-diseased. Having health-related consequences may also be positive. And it says very little about the nature of the disposition itself. Okay? So that's why I have a second tentative definition of disease. So a disease is a disposition acquired by a relatively isolated causal system to have its external membrane or covering damaged through the coming into existence of a pathological structure. Now, it would be really be unfair to ask your comments on this, because I'm quite sure that you have no idea what a relatively isolated causal system is. Does anybody? Good. Well, that comes from a very nice paper from Barry. It's called 16 Days, and it's about the explanation at what time that tumor that is growing into a pregnant woman, at what time it ceases to be a tumor and becomes a person, right?
It's not growing into a pregnant, it's growing inside, in the topological interior.
Yes. Well, I'm joking a little bit, but it has to do with that. And I think it was a very interesting paper, because then I really started, by reading that, I really started to see what the advantages is of thinking in a realist ontological way. So there, that notion is defined. First thing is, an entity is a relatively isolated causal system, even only if the entity has an external boundary which is established via physical covering or membrane, which extends continuously across all or almost all of its surface. Second, there are events inside the entity, and they have characteristic magnitudes which either fall or fall not within a certain spectrum of allowed values. Think of the heartbeat of a human, okay? Think of the temperature, the body temperature, the weight. Weight is not a good example, but the temperatures. And the latter, so those with fall outside the spectrum of allowed values, are distinguished by the fact that they will be in accumulation, lead to the entity ceasing to exist. Third element is that the external membrane of covering serves as a shield to protect the entity from those causal influences deriving from its exterior, which are likely to give rise to events which are outside its spectrum of allowed values. And fourth, the entity contains within itself its own mechanisms which are able to maintain or re-establish when they were disturbed, of sequences of events falling within the spectrum of allowed values. And it also contains mechanisms for reconstituting or replacing in its internal membrane or covering in case of damage. So if you look at these things, then there are a number of entities that qualify as relatively isolated causal systems, such as or complete organisms, human beings, also unicellular organisms. And certain parts of organisms, cells, organ systems, some organs, some maximal portions of tissue, so they fall within that definition. And that is then also nice, because it opens the possibility for an entity to be a disease of a body part without being a disease of the organism of which that body part is a part, but yet being a disease in that organism. So that's the old problem that Galen at the time had, when he's a disease of your pink, is that the disease of your arm, and is that the disease of you? So if you reason these kinds of things, then you don't have that problem. So, in this far, I have been working out this part. Remains to be done, that part. Part four. Okay. Yeah, I'll say yes.
Going back to two slides, I think, I'm not sure whether human beings would qualify, because we depend on all kinds of the bacteria which are not literally part of us. Well, they're, you know, in our stomach I'm not a biologist. I don't know where these things are. Uh-huh. Definitely. So it's not.
But which of the four criteria does it violate? Which of those four does that violate? I mean, that correct the statement only, that you make.
You define the organism or the system as a functional system, a functional unity which has the ability of self-preserving, and if there's a disturbance to respond to it. And we without the our symbionts wouldn't probably be able to do it. At least, or a cow wouldn't be able to do it, because they depend on the symbionts to process the food they eat. So it would not be the human being or the cow wouldn't be the unit which falls under your definition, but more the functional unity of the cow and its symbionts.
Right, yes, that might be. So I have to look into that, that's right.
Okay.
Anything else? Okay, part four, diagnostic decision making from an ontological and epistemological perspective, how to come to a diagnosis. Okay, let's give some common notions an ontological flavor. First, there is that one is called the clinical picture. So I see a clinical picture as a spatial temporal entity that you can compare to a theater play. I mean, a theater play, there are actors and they are doing stuff on the scene and so on. So which means that there are temporal parts. And those temporal parts, they form what is called the course of the disease. And they have spatial parts, which are the pathological formations and the pathological anatomical structures. So in a sense, as they have been defined before. notion of pathological entities any part of a clinical picture. A pathological process is an organismal process that contributes to the dysfunctioning of the organism or any of its parts. So that relationship here between disease and course of the disease, and that seems to cause some problems yesterday during the discussions, certainly. So if we see it as Joe's disease as a disposition, then everything, when it becomes actualized, you have a series of processes and events and so on, which are called Joe's disease course, which is a processual entity. And of that course, there are several parts which are creations of pathological formations and of pathological anatomical structures in Joe. I still put here a question mark for what that actual relation would be, based on some considerations. So if in a RICS, relatively independent causal system, a disposition is realized in such a way that it can't get the type of disease anymore. So imagine that getting your disease, well, you certainly will die, not immediately, but it will take you a week or whatever. So the question is then, which means that you then can't get that disease anymore. So in principle, the disposition is lost. Okay. Or another thing would be that you become immune while still having that disease. You become immune to get it the second time, which means that the disposition is then also away. Then you have the odd situation that the disease would have come an end, but its course has not come to an end. That looks a little bit counterintuitive. We also tend to say, and I'm quite sure it is taped, I guess, so when I will recall, I will notice later that probably I will have said already a couple of times the disposition for the disease. While the disposition is the disease.
Right? No,
it is also counterintuitive.
You can have a disposition to catch a certain disease, for instance, if you have a genetic mutation of a certain sort. But that disposition does not need to be realized. Mm-hmm. If that disposition is realized, then you do indeed catch the disease. And that's a bit like catching a ball.
But is that not then giving disease two different meanings? Are you using the word in two different meanings?
No, I don't think I did. Did I use it in two different meanings?
No. But what did you catch then? You didn't catch the disposition.
No, you caught the disease, which is a second disposition. This is a disposition to have a certain family of manifestations.
Oh yeah, okay.
To undergo certain kinds of processes in certain kinds of stages. But you can have a disease without realizing all of those processes for all kinds of different reasons, including drugs and environment and the immune system and so on.
I accept. But that means that each time you are in the course of a disease, you in fact have two diseases. One which is a disposition and the one that you catched.
No.
Assuming a disposition is a disease.
But that's the claim.
No, you have a disposition to catch the disease. As soon as you catch it, that disposition is realized. It's no longer a disposition. When it's like the glass breaking. When the glass breaks, it's no longer fragile.
Okay, go on. I think.
I hope.
Well, otherwise, fire me.
So then you have a disposition to have signs and symptoms because those are variable when you have a disease? Is that?
The realization of a disposition is a certain process called the course of the disease. That process involves, depending on the terminology that you like, signs, symptoms, manifestations, clinical manifestations, preclinical manifestations, death.
When you have the disease, you have the disposition to have signs, symptoms.
Exactly.
And you could have a disposition to have a disease, which would be a genetic variant, but not have the disease.
Right. Yeah, I see. Okay.
And that have the disease.
So I have to change a couple of things in these slides.
Maybe you want to give an example.
So then that's not valid. Okay, then the other thing is creations of pathological formations and of pathological anatomical structures in Joe lead to new dispositions, but are these dispositions then distinct diseases? Okay, now again, take the example of an infection. A virus enters one cell in Joe, so that cell catches the disease, right? That's disease number one. The virus enters a second cell. Is it then a second disease? Barry?
So a virus is an independent continuant. A disease is a dependent continuant. So no virus is identical with any disease.
No, of course not. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, okay, you have a cell. as a relatively independent causal system. The virus enters the cell. Does a number of proteins start to work? Does a number of things? The cell has the disease. Catch the disease, right?
If that all of that happens that you just described.
Yes. Good. Good. So the cells expels those virus things.
Yep.
Come into a second one. So the same thing in some sense. Is that a second disease?
This is indeed an interesting question about how you count diseases. So let's suppose you have seven cells in your body. They each get attacked by seven different viruses, and in each case, the immune system takes care of business. Let's suppose you have just one virus which enters one cell, but that virus works on the cell in such a way that the viral infection then spreads. Is that correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then you would, from the very start, have just one disease which starts at the cellular level, but then spreads to become a disease of the whole organism.
Good.
Did you ask the question?
Well, he nodded, so.
I didn't.
It's not a second disease.
The question.
Yeah, well, but it gives enough for me to think about it, yes.
Okay.
Right. So let's now look more into the relationship between beliefs about diseases and clinical pictures. And these are what is going to appear now is a list of what you can consider axioms about the reality, or representations about reality, and they can each be discussed. The purpose is not now to discuss them, but just to give a couple of examples of what things there are. So a particular person may exhibit particular pathological entities. A particular clinical picture starts to exist at the time the first pathological process, that is the realization of particular disease, starts to exist. If there are some dramatic things, so raise a finger, right? If you have some dramatic mistakes, yes.
What do you mean by clinical picture?
Well, I just said that. Term? Yeah, I mean it's that spatio-temporal entity which has temporal parts, which are the processes, which are the realization of the disease, and which are things that are created, such as pathological formations and pathological anatomical structures.
The traditional objection to that is the whole notion of preclinical disease, where it's not, there is no clinical picture.
Yeah, I come to that. 6-0.
I think you're not counting those questions which you did not have answers.
Then you have to phrase them as a critique.
I think it's about 6-6 so far, but we will keep counting properly henceforth.
Right. Okay.
But we'll call it a draw so far.
Okay. did I say that already? Yes, I said that already. Okay. Particular clinical picture ceases to exist when the last pathological process, that is the realization of the disease, comes to an end, and when there are no more pathological formations or pathological anatomical structures that were formed by the course of the disease.
But in that case, many diseases will never end.
Oh, yes.
They leave manifestations.
Yes. Yeah. Well, there are some variants. I come to that.
But I think that this is an interesting case. So supposing that you have some sort of failed birth and a very tiny embryo remains in the womb, mm-hmm, for the rest of the woman's life, then we wouldn't, if that failed birth doesn't have any pathological consequences, sorry, if that pathological entity does not have any pathological consequences but survives, we would not say that the woman is diseased. Mm-hmm. Even though there is a pathological entity inside her. So you need to add that these pathological entities have adverse consequences if you're going to say...
That's by definition.
Or have a disposition to have adverse.
Yeah, no, but that's by definition. Otherwise it would not be pathological anatomical structure. So I can go back to that slide, but trust me, it's there.
Then I would draw my answer.
Okay. No, it was there. Further, a particular disease exists in a particular person before a particular clinical picture is present in that person. There can be no clinical picture without a disease. Remember that because pathological formations and so were there. So you can see a lot of things, okay, but not everything that you see is a clinical picture, right? I hope what you are seeing here is not a clinical picture, unless I'm telling totally nonsense. Then it is.
Well,
who said
that? Can't you? I did.
Oh.
I mean, I get it. So can't you go to a physician, have a physical exam, and be found not to have any issues?
Yes, of course. Yes, of course, yes.
But yet there will be a clinical picture.
No, because by definition, as I said, there must be pathological formation and those kind of things in it. That's why I said not everything that you see is a clinical picture. It's a picture.
Well, it denies health.
Uh-huh.
This denies health.
Yeah.
So health is an important thing that is in medical records.
Yes, I agree. I need to describe it, but it's not true. The same thing, yes, I come to you. The same thing for you. No, if you simulate, then it is not there, then you simulate. So then you simulate the clinical picture, but it's not a clinical picture.
I'm coughing.
Under my definition.
I simulate for practice.
Uh-huh.
I go to physician and I simulate clinical signs of disease.
Yep, that's not a clinical picture. I agree with you again. The word clinical picture would be used in that sense in which you are using it now. But it is not a sense that I'm using it. Okay? So I would then use it, say you simulate the clinical picture and you have a problem as a physician, you have an epistemological problem. Because you seem to see a clinical picture while in reality you don't see a clinical picture. Right? That's important. Keep that always in mind, the difference between what you perceive, what you believe to be there, and what is there. So in all my presentation I will go much more in detail in that. You will see that.
I think you'll get better acceptance of this if you use different words than clinical picture.
I agree.
Clinical picture
okay.
is too broad.
Okay, but help me in making it better. Yes, I fully agree.
A clinical picture designatum.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
Sandra, would you bring me some juice? Thank you. I think this was apple, the yellow thing.
Why don't you call it a pathological picture?
No, it's the picture which is the problem. So the word picture here implies a representation. We're talking about the representatum, the clinical
Greek.
Process or something. Clinical, total clinical process gestalt.
Well, I'm not going to solve it now, but okay.
But I think you need to be able to accommodate health.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I agree. So, further, person may exhibit different particular diseases during his lifetime, some or all of them of the same disease type, and some or all of them at the same time or during overlapping time slots. Clinical picture can continue to exist although its disease ceases to exist, right? Remaining scars, that's another thing that you said. You don't, if you have a scar or something, you don't do it. Healthy carriers of viruses, okay? They don't have the disease. Yeah.
What about the second point?
There can be no clinical picture without the disease. Yeah, that's
Never
by definition
form.
As well.
Never form?
Yeah.
Okay, that seems to be directly in conflict.
Clinical picture can't continue to exist.
Yeah, I agree.
These two things cannot both be true.
Right.
Yeah, well, only if the scars are not to be seen as pathological structures.
Right.
Then it would be right.
He wins that one.
Yeah, I must defend myself better. But it's still, I got somebody here on my side. Right?
One or the other.
I'm sure he's not on your side.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
You have to have one or the other.
Okay, good. What's the score, Barry?
7-6 against you.
No, that's awful. Okay, instances of the same disease may lead to non-similar clinical pictures even in the same person. Okay. The flu that I will do now give maybe not a clinical picture than the one that I had last year. The course of some particular disease may lead to other particular diseases of the same or different disease types in a particular person. I take here the example, I don't remember. I mean, it's so long time ago that I did do medicine, so I don't know whether it is indeed varicella that you get as a child that may give you later zoster as an adult. It's right.
Yeah.
So that's an example of these kind of things. A particular disease of type A in one person may lead to a particular clinical picture of type B, while a particular disease of that same type A in another person may lead to a clinical picture of a totally different type. Right. Yeah?
I'm slightly unsure about the varicella zoster.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that this is the same disease manifested differently at different ages. So these are not different diseases, and just the fact that we use two different terms, names, does not prove these are different diseases.
No, but I mean numerically different, okay? So are you going to say once you trapped varicella, so then you are diseased for the rest of your life? and then you get that later on the zoster, which is then just that manifestation of the disease that you were carrying the entire time.
And you can have the same etiologic agent give you different diseases, like Epstein-Barr virus can give you mononucleosis or a lymphoma, so you can't just go by a single etiologic agent.
It clearly depends on the disease, but if a disease is a predisposition, once you get this virus, you have predisposition for varicella and you have predisposition for zoster.
Mm-hmm. It's what the disease actually, when the disease actually occurs. There's almost no overlap in signs and symptoms between those two diseases.
Yes, Chris?
I disagree with your second point.
Okay.
In that if you take the prototype of a disease, if you accept such a term, it can have a spectrum or a constellation of manifestations. We can all agree on that. And it becomes, if you will, this variable penetrance thingy. In that a particular person may have a different manifestation of some of those characteristics,
mm-hmm.
and another person might manifest a different constellation, yep. of those characteristics. I would quibble to say that it's a totally different type, because presumably at some level all those characteristics are being manifest, just with different degrees of penetrance.
Okay. Yes, I can live with that. Yeah. And there are many more. So one of the things, I think I gave a good start to some, to sketch some relationship between those things that can be further discussed, and if somebody is interested to write a joint paper on this and expand that, so feel free to contact me. Now, that notion of findings and observations, so there are also a number of things. A particular pathological entity may at a certain time be undetectable by any observation method or technique available to an observer, including the person exhibiting the pathological entity itself. So, quite often happens that you don't know that you are diseased. Okay, this is not purely ontology, and there's epistemological notions into it. Particular observation may produce false results and assimilate the existence of a pathological entity. An observer may observe or fail to observe a detectable particular pathological entity. This is what good doctors should try to avoid, that it happens. When an observer perceives a particular pathological entity, he might judge it to be an instance of the universal of which it is indeed an instance in reality, so he's right, or to be an instance of another universal, so he's wrong, or he might not be able to make an association with any universal at all, okay?
Just rubs his shoulders.
Distinct manifestations of the same type may be pathological or not. Okay, singing naked under the shower is less pathological, I would say, than doing that in front of the White House. Well, I said less pathological. Good. Part 5, making diagnosis in an ever-changing world. Reality and belief both are in evolution. And this answers very much the last question that Alan had in relation to Lou's presentation. So reality changes, belief changes, okay? What you saw happening here is a universal came into existence, and a second one came into existence, a particular came into existence. At that time, that particular was an instance of that universal. At the latest time, that particular becomes a universal, an instance of that universal. And also beliefs change. So what happened here at this time, somebody or science thinks that this thing exists, then it stops to believe that it exists. Okay? Something else is believed to be in exist, stops to exist, and so on. The same for particulars. Okay? So some things can believe to be exist rightfully or not rightfully. What is very important is that refers to relation. Okay? So if you put in a representation, so these, let again summarize, these are the representational units, this is reality, these are representational units. Okay? In principle, a representational unit has to refer to something in reality. Okay. Now you see these do that, so that's why I've given the same numbers. Okay? This doesn't. Okay? So in fact this thing, if you have a thing like that in an ontology, is meaningless. So that's my understanding of what meaning is. So meaning is reference.
May I make a terminological suggestion.
Yes.
Just use not refer to, but denote or something else.
Okay, I don't get
refer,
it.
In a philosophical literature, refers to is used for a very specific subkind of what you're talking about.
Okay, thank you. Send me that in an email and some paper. So yes, thanks. And you can also believe at certain times that the particulars that you see are instances of certain universals. But you can be wrong, okay? So, just with that picture, there are several milestones. So milestones in the evolution of history, and milestones in the evolution of science, and milestones in the application of science to specific concrete cases. So that's the kind of thing that I'm trying to tell you here. So at this stage there's total ignorance. So cavemen, you just live, no perception or whatever. At this time there is a false belief in the existence of a type. So this is the unicorns example. So you take in your ontology a notion, but it doesn't denote anything. So this is a false belief. It can happen also at the level of particulars. Think of the planet Vulcan that was believed to exist some years ago. Well, many years ago. That happens. So here you have the coming into existence of a new universal. So that universal you too here. But it remains unnoticed. So nothing changes in the beliefs. Okay? What's the situation that AIDS, I'm quite sure, existed already as a disease before it was discovered. Right? So that's this situation. There, you have the coming into existence of a particular. Say, for instance, John Doe's colonic polyp. And from that time on, it is an instance of universal one. Okay? But you also see that, oh, I forgot to mention it. Oh, no, I did mention it. The coming into being of a new particle remains unnoticed, right? Which happens every day. An advancing science here. The existence of this universal becomes acknowledged. Here, because John Doe went to a physician and he examined him, so the existence of John Doe's benign colonic polyp is discovered. But however, at that time, it is not recognized as being such a thing. So, what does this situation represent? You see something, and you say clearly, yes, that thing exists, but you assign it to be an instance of a wrong universal. Right? In this case, you assign it, you think it is something which in reality does not exist. An example would be, you're a witch. Okay? So you exist, and you say, oh, that's an instance of a witch, but witches don't exist. That's this situation. Another advancing science, okay? It is discovered that this O0 thing doesn't denote anything, so it's removed from the ontology. Witches and unicorns are removed from the ontology. Now, interesting thing at this point, there should be some revision on all the things that were believed to be instances of that. Okay? Because at this point, science says, okay, there are no such things, but we were still in a database that this particular here is an instance of that thing. Okay, so here is the question, are we going to update our data repositories in terms of the advance of science? Next stage, it is in this case rightfully believed that P3 is an instance of UI1. Okay, so this thing was reconsidered. Now it raises, amongst other things, the question to what point in history this belief can be extended. Okay? So if at this point a physician says, uh-oh, what I thought to be this is in reality that, how far might he go back here? Okay, at this time he can say, okay, it never could have been an instance of this thing, because science already says it never existed. But it might still have been an instance of something else, right? In that case, here P3 changes from a benign into a malignant tumor. At the time, and that's important, okay, at the time that science did not discover malignancy yet. This is all for the sake of example, eh? Because so if we now say, okay, this universal here, so malignancy became here in the world, okay, but in our science it is not recognized as such. Now what does this mean for John Doe? that his polyp at this time became malignant, but we still believe that it is benign. And it's under such circumstances that we even don't know what malignancy is. Okay? Advanced in science, malignancy is discovered. However, that it applies to John Doe's polyp has not yet been noticed. The one interesting thing is, okay, under what circumstances, again, if an advance in science is made, what should we do with our annotations, databases, or whatever? Later stage, John Doe's polyp becomes recognized as an instance of a malignant tumor. So, you see, we are getting more and more in sync with reality as our investigations continue, both of science and of particular cases, we get more in sync with this reality. But you can also do other things. So in this case, so John Doe's polyp was irradiated and believed to have vanished, while in reality it is not. So we think it is disappeared, but it's still there. So we are wrong again. Here John Doe is lucky. Indeed, his tumor disappeared. And also the physicians who believed it was already gone are lucky because they escaped a lawsuit. And then here, well, that's a little bit a sneer thing, but allow me to do so. For utilitarian reasons, the pragmatic engineers remove malignancy from the ontology. Because they say it's very pragmatic. So if it is not believed to exist, you can't get lawsuits for failures in recognizing instances. Well, entirely a joke, okay, but nevertheless. Well, there are other possible situations, okay, but you see how many, with that simple schema, how many different things there are that should be captured in one way or another in an electronic health record or in an ontology. And there are even more. Suppose that this was the situation, okay, so here you believe that some particular still exists while in reality it does not, okay. Elvis is not dead, okay. Some people believe he's still out there, others say he's being kidnapped by aliens. But a more pragmatic example are the many electronic health records where a physician at one day notes, okay, this patient is taking this or that drug, but nevertheless never take the trouble when the patient stops taking the drug to note that it stops taking the drug. So you keep these kind of information forever in your electronic health record. Or artifacts on radiographic images, you see things, but they do not refer to anything. And then I didn't even discuss at this point, so the relationships that there really are in reality amongst universals, and the relationships that we believe there to be amongst universals. So if we take these into account as well, you have many, many more situations.
I submit you're conflating belief with reported observations that may or may not be
updated. No. I'm coming to that. No. Oh, I'm happy. 7-7 again. So, if we take some summary, what do we have then? We have mistakes. So these were plain mistakes. Mistakes in the sense that are active things. Okay, we did something. So here, say, we introduce something in the ontology and what we do is wrong. In this case, we claim this to be an instance of something and that is wrong. It's an active mistake. There are discoveries, okay? Discovering that something starts to exist, discovering that something doesn't exist anymore in a rightful way. We can simply be lucky, such as in this case. And we were already believing that this is vanished, so we think case closed, in reality it's not, but then nature is such that it indeed stops being, and we were lucky there. From that position on, our database, so to speak, is correct, although we didn't do anything. Okay, that's inactive. And we can have bad luck, okay, which, you know, in all those cases where reality changes and we don't perceive it. So a crucial question is, do we have some means to assess how good we are doing in our understanding of reality? And some might argue no, because every representational unit will always rest on a belief. I say yes, if one keeps track of the reasons in function of the three levels discussed before, for which one's beliefs have changed, then we can do so. And that's part 6, tracking, if I have time. I think I do. Yes, we have half an hour, it's 12:30. Yes. Okay, and if I can't finish, this is the topic of the presentation that I will have at FOIS later this week and at AMIA, I think it is on Tuesday. It's a little bit a combination of both. So remember our three fundamentally different levels: reality on the side of the patient, the cognitive representations in our minds, and the concretizations into representational artifacts. Concrete example, in reality you have males and females, and I don't want discussions now under genetic gender and administrative gender, just take one gender. We have cognitive representations of male and female, and we find in electronic health records male, female, and unknown. Okay? If you are not aware of those three levels discussed before, then you might start to get wrong interpretations of what this unknown is. Okay? Is that another type of phenotypic gender, or is that you don't know whether it is male or female? Okay? So as things like that should be worked out. A second thing is ontology evolution. Alan brought it up, it's crucially important. Okay? Well, I claim that the way that currently is dealt with ontology evolution is for a great deal wrong, and it's missing the point. There is an enormous bias under for these kind of things. So working out the specifications of it, so add a subtree, delete a subtree, whether the subtree has moved, and so on. That are the kind of things that are indeed studied. Say this Natalia Noidos, this kind of things. I just discovered a PhD thesis, October 2nd, right? Say where the entire thesis goes only about those kind of things, where the branches in an ontology have been moved and how to deal with that. But that thing, I mean, that's not the entire point. But the point is why those changes are made. And I try to explain that in terms of those three levels. So you have the changes in the underlying reality. Oops. Does the appearance or disappearance of an entry in a new version of an ontology relate to the appearance or disappearance of entities or of relationships among entities? Okay. So in what way does our ontology keep track of reality? Changes in our understanding, reassessments of what is relevant for inclusion in an ontology. So it might very well be that we know this and this is the case, but that we say, for the purposes of the ontology, it's irrelevant to put it there. And we can make encoding mistakes. An optimal ontology, in my view, if you conceive it under realist terms, should be artifacts created for some purpose, okay? It may serve as a controlled vocabulary for annotation, or it might provide domain knowledge to a software application, must have a purpose. Are at the same time intended to mirror reality and should allow reasoning which is efficient from a computational point of view. And my claim is that an optimal ontology should constitute a representation, for these reasons, of all and only those portions of reality that are relevant for its purpose. Which means that each term in such an ontology would designate a single portion of reality relevant to the purposes of the ontology, so that the authors of the ontology intended to use this term to designate this pore, and there would be no portion of realities objectively relevant to these purposes that are not referred to in the ontology. But of course, things may go wrong. Okay? There are assertion errors. Ontology developers may be in error as to what is the case in their target domain. There may be relevance errors. There may be an error as to what is objectively relevant to a given purpose. There may be encoding errors. They may not successfully encode their underlying cognitive representations, so that particular representational units fail to point to the intended portion of reality. And as we will see, they may be point to nothing at all, or they may point to the wrong thing. Take, I once had the experience with the wrong interpretation of COLD. Okay, it was in Medra, where some related things refer to the chronic obstructive lung disorders and the others simply to common cold, okay, because twice COLD was used. Well, that is a typical mistake of an encoding error. Now, key requirement for versioning: any change in an ontology or data repository should be associated with the reason for that change to be able to assess later what kind of mistake has been made. So take again an example. You can have in John Smith's electronic health record at time T1 male and at time T2 female. So a change is made. But what is the reason for the change? What happened there? If you just look, oh, we move a branch from here to there, it doesn't answer anything. There are many possibilities. Can be a change in reality. So could have undergone transgender surgery. Or it may be a change in legal self-identification. Okay, in most American states, I think there is a law that you may go somewhere and you say, I'm a male. And you may go to another state and you say, I'm a female. Okay, and they are obliged to put it in the database in that way. Might be something like that. Might be a change in understanding. It was female from the very beginning, but interpreted wrongly. Happens sometimes. Newborns. Right? I couldn't find, with this example, a convincing case for a change in relevance. So leave that out. But it could also be a correction of a data entry mistake. So it was understood from the very beginning as male, and somebody made a stupid mistake, typed the wrong button, and it get ended up like that. Good. So if you combine the possibilities, you get a chart like this. So here there are several situations that combine a little bit everything. Here you have a reality. Here you have the understanding, and then here you have the encoding. So OE means objective existence, and ORV, object is relevance. Here you have believed existence and believed relevance. Here you have the notion whether your representational unit in your ontology does indeed have the intended encoding, and in that case it refers, so this is automatically tied with that, but in cases when it is not, then you can have the possibility that it does not refer, or it refers to the wrong thing. Okay. So here, for instance, we have the situation that there exists something in reality. It is objectively relevant for the purposes of your ontology. The authors of the ontology believed that it exists. They understood the relevance. They encoded it in the correct way. So, and this is an ideal situation. So P plus one is a situation where everything is done right. What is important as a first step is to see the differences between those two columns. Okay, so these reflect part of the mistake. So a yes, yes means correct assertion of the existence of a portion of reality. Yes, no means there's a lack of awareness of a portion of reality. So this is a type of an assertion error. No means the correct assertion that some putative portion of reality does not exist. So we have an example here, this one, okay? Something does not exist, and we understand that it does not exist. Now, of course, in principle, these things, you don't have them in the ontology. So that's what I say. What in principle should be the case is that if a version of an ontology is released, the authors should commit to the fact that all their units are P plus one, and that they have a site somewhere, a list of A plus one and A plus two, which are things which say, okay, we do know they do not exist, so we put them not in the ontology, or we do know that they are not relevant for our purposes, so we also do not put them in our ontology. And this is already what I said, so this captures whether a thing refers or does not refer. And then the nice part, by doing that we can go, we have a means to go and look better at evolutions through different versions. So what you have here is that at time t, so there is a situation p plus 1 or a plus 1 or a plus 2, and then at time plus 1 something changes. So you can either change something in reality objectively, or in the relevance, or in our belief of the existence, or in the belief of the relevance, and so on. And if you do the mathematics by looking to the way in which one situation can make a transition towards another one, you can get this chart. Okay, so a P plus one, when there is a change in reality, moves into a P minus one, or when there is a change in objective relevance, it moves into a P minus six, and so on. With each change, there is also, go back to the previous slide, something that you gain. Okay. So if you consider this to be the correct situation, and this one as well, correct omissions, then here you have entities or situations which are wrongly in the ontology, and here you have situations which are wrongly absent in the ontology. Okay? And you can see how they deviate from the ideal case, and that is expressed in this row here. So here I simply use the number of mistakes that are made in differences from yes or no at that level. A column that I forgot to explain is this one. This is if you do not take reality into account. So if you do ontology building in the normal conceptual way, where you just say refers to a concept, then you can't get these, how many are there, 18 or 17 different situations, then you only get 5. Because a number of them conflate and you are not aware of it. Okay? With this mechanism, you are much more detailed. Well, anyway, these gains or losses when you make changes in a ontology are again reflected here. So if you move from a P plus 1 to a P minus 1, you lose 3 points for that representational unit. If you move from here to there, you lose 1 point, yeah, and so on. So let's take this example in detail. So an entity ceases to exist, but the representation is not updated. Okay, so we have, in fact, this situation here in the beginning. Okay, the entity ceases to exist, so objective existence moves from yes into no. Okay, and of course, then there is no, there is still the intended representation, but it represents nothing anymore. We have that difference, we have the change into that. So the P plus 1 changes in a P minus 1, and you lose 3 points. Now, updating is an active process. Authors assume in good faith that all included representational units are of the P plus 1 type, and all they are aware of, but not included, of A plus 1 or A plus 2. If they become aware of a mistake, they make a change, under the assumption that their changes are always towards P plus 1, A plus 1, or A plus 2. Okay, they are not going to deliberately make mistakes in the ontology. Thus, at the time they know of what type the previous entry must have been under the belief what the current one is and the reason for that change. So if they make a change, they say, okay, at time t, this representational unit, I thought it was correct. But now I realize this kind of mistake was being made. Then they can reason backwards and say, okay, if I assume that I'm right now, then at that time, it must have been of another type, and from that table you can deduce what type it must have been. And this leads to a calculus. So, not to demonstrate how good an individual version of an ontology is, but rather to measure how much it is believed to have been improved, hopefully, as compared to the predecessors. So let's take that as an example. So we have at time t, the belief that this is correct. But in reality, we don't know, but in reality, this is the situation. It is a p minus 7. Okay, so what is the difference? That the thing exists, we believe it exists, and it exists. Okay, we believe it is objectively relevant, but it is not. Okay? So in that case, we have here a p minus 7 from the table. Suppose now at time t plus 1. And there is a second mistake here, that the intended representation is wrong. Okay, so we did not encode, in fact, what we believe to be the case because of an encoding mistakes. So at time t plus 1, this intended encoding is corrected, which then means that if we assume that this is correct, then the unit as at time t must have been of the type p minus 4 rather than p plus 1, as it is reflected here. And introducing that change, you would then get a gain of 1. But suppose at time t plus 2, just finish this and another question. At time t plus 2, the unit is assumed to refer to nothing. Thus it is removed from the representation. This means that you have to go back in time and to see what the situations then would have been under that new assumption. So it means that at t plus 2, you get now an a plus 1, because if it refers to nothing, you remove it from your database, you think it is an a plus 1. Then at time t plus 1, it must have been a p minus 1 instead of a p minus 4. And at time t, when you thought it was a p minus 4, it must have been a p minus 2. Now all the... okay. Now the question. The lady was first there.
What about the case where your original ontology actually did reflect reality, but then you believe something will change, but it actually is wrong? So you believe that you're making an improvement, but then you're actually making something worse.
Oh, well, but that's captured there. Of course. Of course, all possible combinations are in that table. But you took...
But then you're going to...
No, 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 No. It will work out if you look at the way in which it is compared with reality. If you make it worse, you can't get better figures.
But you don't know that you're making it worse.
You know the next time. So now, knowing under the sense that if you believe that this is the case now, then you must also believe that it was the case, that it was such a case at time t minus 1, at time t minus 2, and so on. If you do the math of those things and you put the figures there, then you see how the points that you get go higher or lower depending on what you are doing. Okay? So it is not the case, that's why I clearly said, so with this methodology you can't say this ontology is that good. The only thing that you can say is it evolved over time in such a way, and you can see over time what the current version, how it compares to the previous one, and so on. Yeah.
Then it's going to say the previous one was worse.
Yes.
When in reality it was actually better.
Oh yeah, but that can be. That can be the case. So that can exactly be the case, yes. You can make a mistake by removing from something from the ontology because you think it is right and because you are wrong. But this table exactly allows you to represent that situation.
No, it just describes what you think.
Yeah, it describes at any moment what you think, but if you think X at this time and you are faithful to your reasoning, then you must believe that at the prior time the situation was such. And it is these differences in these beliefs that you count.
But isn't it then a self-fulfilling prophecy that each time you make an improvement to the ontology, it's an improvement? Because you believe that it's an improvement.
But you can't know at that time. So you don't know whether an ontology, when you release it, whether it is an improvement over the previous version. You will only know at time t, you know whether t minus 1 was an improvement over t minus 2. That's what you know. It's tricky to think about it, but it works out, yeah?
I'm having trouble separating how you're perceiving an ontology from how you're perceiving essentially instance data or universals versus, I forget your
particulars.
Particulars, thank you. The example you used was discontinuing medication in a particular patient.
Yeah.
In fact, the fact that they're no longer taking the medication doesn't make the assertion of that at time T false.
No, absolutely not.
And so I'm having, my little brain is having trouble understanding how this graph that you're using, that I assume would apply primarily to universals.
Both.
If you apply it to instances, the whole question of incomplete information, unknown information,
yes,
starts to really be a database integrity issue more than it is an ontology issue.
It's a combination. So, and my claim is indeed that electronic healthcare record system, and I think that's my next slide. I think it's my next slide. Yeah, whether this can be implemented, okay? I think it can. But of course, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, it must be done. I think that for at least ontology ordering systems should have an additional functionality when something is changed in the ontology. You can indeed click a button and say, this is the reason for the change, because I, according to those things. And the same thing for electronic healthcare records. So if you make a change, as the example that I gave from male to female, okay, that there is a mechanism that you let you know, okay, why that was. Changing reality, changing belief, correcting the mistakes, or whatever. In the ideal case, your database will migrate along similar lines as reality migrates, okay? So if a patient takes your drug, and you register it now that he takes drugs, reality continues, he stops after 10 days, but in your database he's still sitting there, okay? You may not infer that he is still taking it, okay? That would be wrong. But at a certain time you see the patient again, or for whatever reason, it gets updated in the database that he stopped taking the drug, and you are back in sync, okay? Stopping taking a drug does not need you to revise your perception that he started to take it. Okay? That's not the same thing. That's a different thing. The example would be a benign polyp that changes into a malignant one. So that is a better example, because there we are talking about the same thing. The same thing that endures through time, but that becomes an instant of a second thing. So taking medication and stopping medication are two different things. Fabian.
I think it's very interesting to look at the combinations of mistakes which can be made to classify them. And I think I understand your points, way of counting points. I just don't see why this would be helpful. You know, let's see, I would now do some research and find out that the Gene Ontology has collected 100,000 points in the last 2 years. What would that tell me?
I think
except
if you're...
For, it's much better than before, but that's something I knew before already that's improved.
I don't know. I think you have to compare it with... I don't know. It has to be done. I think SNOBET would be an ideal case. If you should say, if we could set up a project where they do change management, and we will where we see, okay, they are changing certain things. Well, each change that we make, let it assign a tag. So to what of those things it can be done, okay? And much of this goes automatically, okay? So you must document the reason, but you can have in your ordering system just radio button and you click up, see this one or it is that one. The maths is completely automatic. You have the table and you can...
I don't argue that. I see how it can be done. The question is, why would I want to do it? Why is the number interesting?
It's always good to have quantitative measure rather than qualitative.
But the quantitative, what are you measuring? You're not measuring something at all, really. I don't know, really understand what you're measuring. Because it's not, as you said, you can't really say for you in an objective matter how much my ontology has improved. You can only compare it with these numbers.
But that's important. That's learning from history. I think it is a method that we can say, if you look back to the past, knowing what we know now, that we know what went wrong in the past, and that if you and I believe that you can see improvements in that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
And if you see those improvements, then you are right.
The number doesn't help me.
It helps me. I mean, it's the same thing I say. Okay, taking the body temperature doesn't help me.
Well,
39 or 41 or whatever.
The body temperature will help you because it's linked to, it's a sign for many things, I guess. It's variation in body temperature. Uh-huh. But I don't know how to relate this number to any significant.
The improvement in the belief quality of the ontology over time. Barry.
Yes, I'm also somewhat skeptical. I can see how this might be helpful for training people. If you give them the exercise of building an ontology for this domain with these specific relevance criteria, and then you can teach them by showing them in each successive attempt how the changes need to be made, they will understand certain kinds of errors. But I can't understand how this will help the expert. Unless you have something like a gold standard, what the reality is, which is relevant to a given purpose, and how it is organized, either as a health record or as an ontology. And I would submit that if you do have the gold standard, then the best you can do and should do is just to represent the ontology that's comprehended within that gold standard.
Yeah, but the problem with the gold standard is that the gold standard can be wrong. So the gold standard will evolve over time as well. And the gold standard is nothing more than your belief in what reality is. So you are circular in your reasoning.
But the notion of a gold standard is used in all kinds of ways in research, not just medical research.
Right, but I think that every latest version adheres to that gold standard. And if you have a new version...
If you're lucky.
No, not if you're lucky. Why?
Well, I can see how that is useful for funding purposes. You can submit that your ontology has improved by this and that number, but there is no real scientific meaning behind the number. It still might be useful for funding purposes, but there's nothing behind it.
Do you believe in reality?
Yeah, sure. But
do you believe in our perception of reality, that it can be wrong?
Yeah,
that can
of course,
be right. Yes. Okay. Do you believe that we can make mistakes in ontologies?
Yeah.
Yes. So I prepare here. a method where you can quantify that. So if you believe in those things, then I think you must believe as well that such a measure is a good thing.
Let's assume I now started ontology and I'm immunology. I have no idea of immunology. So I start with something totally crappy, and then just I make changes all the time, just pulling them out of my head, and collect the and keep track of these changes according to your method. I will still see progress in the long run. I will have a number. My ontology will get better and better according to this number. It will have nothing to do with reality because I don't know anything about immunology. That's the point of your.
But you will see that under your beliefs now, you were doing very crappy things in the past. but that's important because if I have to buy something from you, then I would prefer something. Now I would prefer to buy from somebody from who it can be shown that he did not do crappy things.
Two quick questions, then you're done.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I tend to agree with you because there are all kinds of things that can impact that rate of change. If you don't do anything on your ontology, you could interpret that as it was perfect to begin with, right? Because nothing has changed over time. Your value. I think what's useful here from my perspective is categorizing the types of changes that are made. Because when I look at an ontology and I see that a term has disappeared or moved somewhere, it's not always apparent why that change was made. And so I think having these categories of changes are useful. Whether quantifying it is useful, I'm not sure.
But you get it automatically, so that's the advanced. When you do it, you get it automatically, and now we can see whether it is true. So who had the second question? No. You have to look at the progression. Okay, it's like stock market exchange, the kind of predictions that you make in stock market things.
Quantifying the quality of your belief based on your belief.
Yes.
You will quantify later.
Yes.
I'm not sure if it's not very close to saying that's kind of nonsense. So I mean, the quality of your previous beliefs seems to depend on the belief you have now.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So you can have whatever beliefs. How does it change the quality of your previous beliefs? It doesn't.
Yes, it does.
So it's the reality that kind of is a benchmark. But you have only your beliefs about the reality.
But they change.
Your...
They change over time. It is that time. Well, okay. The lesson that I take from this here is that I must try to explain it much better.
Yeah, but
that's for sure. Okay. Sorry.
More minutes actually.
Oh, you miscalculated.
Yeah, 12 more.
Okay, but yeah, first, Kent.
Yeah. I think something that's getting lost here is the need in extremely large terminologies to do sampling to establish the gold standard. And in that circumstance, you actually do want to track over time. And it's not one person's belief. It's you try to establish the gold standard by doing sampling and sort of consensus process. And monitoring that over time, even retrospectively, gives you the best indication you have of whether you're converging to quality or whether you're not. And I think those are things that people look at and say, how much effort is being expended in making these changes, and where should we direct our effort? So those are the kinds of metrics that we look for to help direct effort in very large efforts. And if it's something really small, like 100 things, and only one person is doing it, then all these arguments about, well, it's sort of irrelevant, make sense. But as soon as it's big, and you have to do sampling, you want to track it, you want to allocate effort, it becomes very important.
And in fact, and for Go has been asked to do precisely that by the NIH.
So what you are saying is that this is important?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, thank you.
But it's more, it's that number divided by per unit effort or
okay.
something like
yes.
that.
Yes, right. Oh, I accept that. Neil.
I think what you've done is made someone like von Frossen very proud in that you started with a realist model. You then separated the ontology on the sort of belief side from the facts of the world. And then you said that what constitutes progress and what constitutes a better ontology is increased empirical adequacy. And you've lost all detachment with your realist world now.
No.
So you have a massive ontological anti-realist model.
No. I disagree. I disagree in all those things. All those things. It's oops, not this thing.
What makes for a better
oops.
Model on your view?
It's always there.
It's empirical adequacy. It's no longer its point of contact with the world. You said that. You said that if we make a mistake and it makes for a better ontology that solves more of the problems, we like it more, it's better.
I did not say that. That's not what is expressed here. The other thing is, what is another measure for seeing whether the quality fulfills its purposes, yes or no, is inside applications. And I think if you have a ontology, well, that would be a good proof to say that this theory would be is nonsense. Suppose that you have applications running out there, doing certain things with a certain version of an ontology, okay? And that ontology is then replaced by a second version, okay? So after the first time, I can't do nothing with this. I need two transitions in order to be able to say something. So let's see that we are on the third transition. There are also other means to see whether that application functions better or not, okay? Well, then we should be able to compare. So whether the metrics that I propose here is indeed goes hand in hand with the kind of metrics that you would get if you were able to measure better performance of your application, which uses a better version of an ontology. The drama is that I think that for many applications you can't measure it at that level. And this can always be done. But it needs to be tested. So I'm really eager to set up some projects to do this kind of things. Fabian, you've got the last one.
Here's the challenge. I think in order to establish a metric, you have to make sure that if Lindsay and I start ontologies on immunology independently, that it is ensured that her ontology gets a better rating than mine because I don't know anything. And according to this, how it works right now, it is just I will be probably have a higher number because I just put in names in there, not caring about anything. But she will, read the literature and start and do some studying before she does some changes. And since I'm adding and adding and adding, I get more points.
No, adding is one on the slice. Adding doesn't give you any points.
I will always claim that I have discovered a new universal which wasn't there before.
But it doesn't give you points.
Anyway, there is nothing in this thing which makes sure that I have less points than her.
You cannot compare your ontology to hers. That can't be done.
Oh yeah, that's my first paper. So exactly the same theory can be used if you try to match them. Okay, so it's not a matter of compare, but if you try to match them, you end up with the same kind of things. So you see a representational unit, you see the same let's now be a little bit sloppy about same. You see another one you think it refers to the same thing, and then you can apply the same metrics.
Okay. No, but that's a challenge. The challenge that's is to get the measurements in a way that this distinction is made.
Okay. Yeah, and I think that Kent already gave the correct response to you, Fabian. You're just happily buzzing away building ontologies, more or less at random, is indeed not going to provide a suitable basis for this kind of measuring approach. What you need is occasional sampling by some ontological expert, some expert in the domain who will look at what you're doing. And there will come a point where they will look at what you're doing and say, okay, you're beginning to get it, now we can start applying the measures. But until you've reached that point where you have a coherent content base that we can apply the measures, it's just not worth doing so.
I'm trying to exaggerate the point here, but there, about the quality of many ontologies which are out there, and they are
that much better than me building.
I know, but so, we need to do, and, we need to this, do something about that.
And so a measurement, anything which is claiming to be a measurement should be...
That's also the answer to that. Neil's point. So the expert knows the relevant reality. And the expert adds that link to the relevant reality, which gives the metric here the capacity to involve reality as a benchmark. Mm-hmm. And you need to emphasize that more.
Okay.
What if the expert believes but does not know?
Yeah.
We
need to find the right experts.
It's still always based on...
No. We know over there.
Is your expert go?
Okay. I went 10 minutes over time, sorry for that. It's now time for lunch and we're at 2 o'clock.
He didn't actually. We're breaking 4 minutes early. So everyone should be back here by 2. And remember that before you leave, whenever you do leave, you should fill in your evaluation form. That's very important because we're going to apply these metrics to run.